Order!
Order! Order!
The week in the House, as in the country at large, was dominated by the aftermath of a massive earthquake, which jolted the northeastern South Island and southern parts of the North Island at 2 minutes past midnight on Monday morning. Among the thousands of aftershocks over the next few days, two were keenly felt in Parliament's debating chamber, both occurring on Tuesday afternoon, and both while Finance Minister Bill English was on his feet answering questions about the government's response to the likely economic impact of the quake.
Well, Mr Speaker, the shorter-term steps have been outlined by the Prime Minister and the Minister in charge of earthquakes.
There is no minister in charge of earthquakes.
So we know that repairing roads and other utilities are costly and long-term solutions.
Picture, if you will, just in your mind, no need to go to a website or switch platforms, a debating chamber full of upturned faces watching light fittings swaying back and forth.
Well, Mr Speaker, this time I'll be more careful what I say.
The Finance Minister in Tuesday's sober and subdued question time, like an oldies scrum, going through the motions without any of the usual pushing and shoving, as noted by the Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, anyone who is a regular observer of question time here in this Parliament may have found today a little quiet, may have found today a little overly constructive. But I just want to, as Leader of the House, acknowledge the various parties who have asked questions in the House today. They've been asked from a very genuine point of view and do express the widest support that this House can give to those who are facing difficult times at the moment.
The Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, who had a busy week, which began on Tuesday with this ministerial statement from the Prime Minister, John Key.
Mr Speaker, just after midnight on Monday, the 14th of November 2016, New Zealand was struck by another severe earthquake. The magnitude 7.5 was one of the largest ever, was 16 kilometres deep and centred near Hamner Springs. It was felt throughout much of the country, and the subsequent aftershocks continue to keep many New Zealanders on edge. Mr Speaker, the damage is serious. Two people have lost their lives and their families are grieving. Our thoughts, of course, are with them. Others are living without power and in damaged homes. In Kaikoura, communities have been cut off. There is no running water or sewage. Supplies have been limited and the phone coverage is unreliable.
Within 24 hours, Mr Key was back with better news, delivered in response to this request from the New Zealand First Party's Ron Mark.
Can he update the House on the situation in earthquake-affected areas in the South Island?
The Mr. Speaker, Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, maybe it would be best if I just gave a quick summary of the most recent visit we've had there a couple of hours ago. What I can say is that on one hand, I think spirits are actually quite high in the Kaikoura region. There's been a significant additional support coming from police, coming from the military, coming from civil defence. The locals, I think, in that regard are feeling well supported by this Parliament and by the services that support them. Secondly, Mr Speaker, what is clear is that there is real concern about the upcoming tourism season and the capacity for tourists to actually get into to Kaikoura because of the damage to road.
The House then heard more about that from the Minister of Transport, Simon Bridges.
It's clear there's been significant, incredibly significant damage to local roads, State Highway 1 between Picton and Christchurch. Crews are working hard to repair roads where it is possible and safe to do so. And while alternative access routes are being established, it's now very clear it may be many months before roads are fully operational, especially given what is now likely to be an unprecedented level of damage to the state highway network.
Within 2 days, Simon Bridges was facing questions like this one from the New Zealand First Party's transport spokesman, Dennis O'Rourke.
This question is to the Minister of Transport. If the Prime Minister has described State Highway 1 as, quote, really stuffed, what are his plans, if any, to assist the repairs of Centre Port upgrade, Littleton Port for ferries, repair State Highway 1 and alternative routes, as well as rail in both islands?
The Honourable Simon Bridges.
Well, Mr Speaker, it's important thing in relation to plans to keep in mind that we're still in the response and recovery phase A more detailed picture is, however, emerging as more information comes to hand. I think if we just take roading, for example, obviously an incredibly important example, the government's already moved quickly to repair and open roading links, but the scale and the complexity of the slips on State Highway 1 that the member mentions are unprecedented, and the task ahead of us is huge.
Simon Bridges' Cabinet colleague, Hekia Parata, faced questions from her Labour shadow, their education spokesman, Chris Hipkins.
Does she think it's fair that students who had studied hard for an exam because they needed a good result in order to get NCEA for their future study and employment are either denied the opportunity to sit or have to sit when they're sleep-deprived and still being shaken by aftershocks?
The Honourable Hekia Parata.
Mr Speaker, the emergency derived grade process, which was the one that was used in the Greater Christchurch area and is used for exceptional emergency situations, relies on the school using the assessments throughout the year to make the case, and that is the process that is being applied here.
Education Minister Hekia Parata. Further along the government's front bench, the Minister for Building and Housing, Nick Smith, was being tackled by his Labour shadow, Phil Twyford.
Does he believe there needs to be a review of the building code, given the damage sustained by modern buildings, such as Statistics House, in this week's earthquakes?
Nick Smith said the issue was not the building code, but the more detailed standards.
The overall performance of most buildings in the quake was good, but there may be others like Standards House that require further investigation as more information comes to hand with the hundreds of assessments that are taking place across Wellington currently.
And those assessments were revealing more and more faults in office buildings in the capital, prompting this question on Wednesday for the Prime Minister, John Key, from the Leader of the Opposition, Andrew Little.
What steps is he taking to respond to the evacuation of Statistics House, Defence Headquarters and now Papatea House, due to the damage in the earthquake that they were supposed to be able to withstand? And just how compromised are government services given the number of public service buildings that seem to have been evacuated?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I'm not aware of a major deterioration in the services that can be provided, but clearly people have moved out of buildings, and when they do that, and we need to do that if they're structurally unsafe. We can't put people back in buildings that are unsafe. There may be some inconvenience and there may be some reduction in service. It's actually not correct to say that even if a building is built to a strong and a high level of code compliance that it can't and doesn't suffer damage as a result of an earthquake. They sometimes do.
Then from the Minister of Civil Defence, Jerry Brownlee, confirmation on Thursday that the magnitude of the earthquake had been officially raised from 7.5 to 7.8.
Mr Speaker, GNS informed my office yesterday afternoon of a revised magnitude after reassessing data from stations across the country. They said that because it took over a minute for the fault to rupture during the event, the standard method normally used to calculate energy released during an earthquake was insufficient. The revised magnitude tells us what everyone knew. It was a big earthquake.
Jerry Brownlee, who later on Thursday led the House in recommending the appointment of former Transport Secretary Martin Matthews as the new Auditor-General to succeed Lyn Provost.
Mr Speaker, the process for choosing a nominee for a position like this, which is an Officer of Parliament, is exhaustively undertaken under your chairmanship, sir, with the assistance of other parties' representatives to the Officers of Parliament Committee. I know that there were a number of applicants who would have met the bill, but the committee has decided to support Martin Matthews.
Among endorsements for Mr Matthews' appointment was one from the co-leader of the Māori Party, Marama Fox.
Mr Matthews has a huge job ahead of him as our country's top public spending watchdog, keeping a close eye on more than 4,000 groups which administer taxpayer and ratepayer dollars. And we encourage him to widen the scope of how his office audits taxpayer-funded entities to ensure they are including two further points in their work. One, whether those groups are giving effect to the principles of Te Tiriti or Waitangi, and whether they are recruiting a diversity of staff that reflect our community.
Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard paid tribute to the outgoing Auditor-General, Lynn Provo.
First, before I speak directly to the motion, I want to place on record the thanks of the House to Lynn Provo for the work that she's done as Auditor-General. Before that, as the first civilian and first woman Deputy Commissioner of Police, and worked with a number of members of the House at the State Services Commission. Her public service has been brilliant.
Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard, who was in the chair at the end of Thursday's special Pacific Issues debate, coinciding with the Pacific Parliamentary Forum held this week at Parliament.
The question is that the motion be agreed to. Those that are of that opinion will say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes have it. Can I, on behalf of presiding officers, also wish delegates well and for you to remember that our House is your House too. The House stands adjourned until 2 p.m. on Tuesday the 29th of November.
And although that was the end of the week in the debating chamber, Friday was a full working day in one of the committee rooms, as Rhys Lyon reports.
This week saw a total of 21 Select Committee meetings held, including three health subcommittees on Friday, hearing submissions on Marion Street's petition calling for an inquiry into public attitudes towards euthanasia. And while those subcommittees were set to hear more than 120 individual oral submissions on Friday, the day before the Justice and Electoral Committee heard just one on the Electoral Amendment Bill 2016. That's a government bill in the name of Justice Minister Amy Adams and aims to make a number of minor changes to the Electoral Act 1993 to, quote, help improve services to voters and assist with the smooth delivery of elections, unquote. But the one submission on the bill heard on Thursday was critical of the process around it, that view coming from Law Society member David Cochrane.
The process is, well, I suppose you'd politely say suboptimal. It's actually awful.
Mr Cochrane said the bill had a number of shortcomings.
The Electoral Commission keeps saying it's about time we did something about emergencies if there's an earthquake. Around election time, what are you going to do? No one knows. Been in the report for 2012, 2015, still hasn't been addressed. I mean, you might sort of think, you know, there's a reasonable chance in the next 12 months of a decent earthquake. What if it's election day?
The Law Society's Law Reform Committee member, David Cochrane, said that with 3 years between each election, such electoral amendment bills should be better considered.
It seems like the whole system is just drifts along for a couple of years, and then, oh gee, there's an election coming up, we better ram some legislation through and as fast as we possibly can. You give the public very little time and take forever within the processes. I mean, this committee isn't reporting back till February, so why the rush?
February the 13th, to be exact. Meanwhile, on Wednesday and over at the Education and Science Committee, MPs heard submissions on the bill seeking to update the country's education laws. One submission came from Wellington East Girls College PPTA Chairwoman Georgette Lampert, who had reservations about proposed Centres of Online Learning, or CoLs.
It is not stated in the bill that a manager of a CoL needs to be a fully qualified teacher or principal. This is highly disturbing to us. Registered teachers are also not required by the bill, and as a group of professionals, we strongly stand together and firmly against this, as we believe the quality of education will decrease if CoLs go ahead.
Ms. Lampert also questioned the social impacts of online-based learning.
We are concerned that CoLs will limit the social development of children at all ages if they are fully enrolled online. Skills such as making friends, negotiating, working as a team member, showing empathy, understanding different cultural practices and navigating new physical environments cannot so easily be learnt online.
Those concerns were echoed by the principal of Tawa College, Murray Lucas.
Just a story, how vital it is to get that face-to-face contact. We had science NCA Level 1 on Monday. We had six students come and I met with them prior to the exam. They showed the whole gamut of emotions after coping with the earthquake. One thought it was the greatest adventure that he'd ever been part of, through to one that was so traumatised they couldn't even remember their name. If we didn't have that sort of human interaction, where are we going with our education system?
And Mr Lucas was supported in that view by his Board of Trustees student representative, Tane McMahon.
We believe that it is really important for social face-to-face time with a teacher and other students. We see that losing the social time with others, we lose a major part of the purpose of school, learning to work with others for our futures.
Tawa College Board of Trustees Student Representative Tane McMahon with that submission on the Education Update Amendment Bill, which is due to be reported back to the House by March the 13th next year.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the Chamber, among the many questions about the earthquake and its aftermath, was this one from the Greens Broadcasting spokesman Gareth Hughes.
To the Minister of Broadcasting, will she join with me to acknowledge the work of all media in New Zealand, which is so important in times of natural disaster and crisis? And if so, will the Minister consider increasing our public broadcaster Radio New Zealand's funding in Budget 2017?
That question from Gareth Hughes was answered for Broadcasting Minister Amy Adams by the Minister ultimately responsible for the budget.
The Honourable Bill English.
Yes, Mr Speaker, I do agree with the Member. The media have done an excellent job of the vital task of keeping the public informed about what they should do at a time of stress. In terms of Radio New Zealand's funding, well, of course, Radio New Zealand, uniquely among media organisations, has a guarantee of revenue for future years, something that many media organisations would regard with envy. However, any bids will be considered in due course as part of the usual budget process.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Gareth Hughes.
How long does the Minister think our only public broadcaster, Radio New Zealand, can continue to provide the high standard of broadcasting we've seen in the last few days when its funding hasn't been increased for 8 years?
The Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr Speaker, clearly up to now they've done a very good job. I haven't seen any noticeable deterioration, in fact some improvements in the broadcasting of Radio New Zealand on the guaranteed funding that they have, which, as I said, makes them unique among media organisations, a number of whom are fighting simply to stay alive.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Gareth Hughes.
Given the Minister's comments around the ability to lodge a budget bid, is the Minister concerned Radio New Zealand didn't put in a funding bid in the last budget round, with the Chairman describing it as, quote, pointless beating your head against a brick wall of reality?
The Honourable Bill English.
Mr Speaker, no, I wasn't disappointed at all. I know for public organisations it can be a sort of an automatic reflex that they bid for more money just because they had some last year and think they can do more good next year. In the case of RNZ, though, over a number of years, they have changed with the times. I'm particularly complimentary of their website development. They see themselves now less as an owner of a broadcasting system and more as a content provider, and I'm sure wider media see benefit in broadcasting content of the quality of RNZ's.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Gareth Hughes.
Given the excellent work of Radio New Zealand that it's done in the last few days, despite a real-term funding cut of $4 million since this government came to office, would the Minister encourage Radio New Zealand to put in a budget bid for the next funding round?
The Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr Speaker, not on that basis. I mean, we don't give public organisations more money just because they've demonstrated their ability to use the money they have. If there's a greater need, then for the long-term sustainability of the organisation, then I'm sure the board and executive of Radio New Zealand will see merit in putting up a bid. Equally, we also try not to give money to organisations where their services habitually fail, because that would also be rewarding organisations rather than just applying money to obvious need.
The call from the Greens broadcasting spokesman for the government to spend more on public radio was echoed in Wednesday's general debate by Labour's Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, all media in New Zealand have performed a good job over the last few days in keeping New Zealanders informed. But Radio New Zealand, in its role as a public broadcaster, has been outstanding in providing service to New Zealand, including Susie Ferguson's amazing run into the studio early on Monday morning. They deserve far better support. Their funding has been frozen for 8 years. Let's make this the occasion that the House decides we need quality public broadcasting and will fund it properly.
Labor's Grant Robertson in Wednesday's general debate, while the next day's question time took the House from one disaster to another, with this question for the Minister for the Environment, Nick Smith, from Labor's West Coast Tasman MP, Damien O'Connor.
What new technical information or advice did he receive, if any, in relation to the possible recovery of the Pike River mine drift prior to the meeting he attended in Greymouth yesterday?
Speaker.
The Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
The new technical information I received was on the methane levels in the drift, which I shared with the families yesterday. It shows methane levels in the mine beyond the new seal, 30 metres into the drift, have rapidly increased and are now over 90%. The mine has over 100,000 cubic metres of this explosive gas present, and combined with the other risks, confirms the advice that entry and recovery of the risk cannot be done safely.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Mr Speaker, why will he not take the advice of the former Chief Inspector of Mines with 40 years international mining experience, who spent several years fixing the regulatory failings of the Pike River disaster, and override the decisions of the board of a bankrupt company, Solid Energy, and allow the recovery of the drift?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
I spoke with the gentleman concerned at last year's anniversary, and as far as he was prepared to go with me is the issue of might. Might. Equally so, under our health and safety law, the advice we do need to take is from those that are legally responsible. Over $5 million has been spent on investigating whether it was possible to gain entry to the drift, and the conclusion of that advice is that it could not be done safely.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Damien.
Does the Minister agree with Tony Forster, a former mines inspector, who in an email to the families yesterday said, quote, New Zealand mining law permits the recovery of a single entry heading under the scheme designed for that purpose. A suitable scheme already exists, in my opinion, and does he accept his offer to be honoured, quote, to be honoured to take part in or lead a drift recovery?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Dr Nixon.
Legal decisions under the Health and Safety in Workplace Law that this Parliament passed has the legal responsibility for safety resting with Solid Energy currently, and when the mine is sealed, it will then return to the Department of Conservation, of which the Director General, Lou Sanson, would then be the person that takes that responsibility. The advice I have received is that the combination of risks, 100,000 cubic metres of methane now in the mine, the issues that there is likely to be a heat source that could trigger an explosion, the fact that the mine was always unsafe without an egress, and the damage that's been done to the strata, increasing the risk of a rockfall, makes the overall risk profile too high, such that drift cannot safely be entered.
Which is, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable
How can a Crown Minister ignore the realities that this mine in Crown land, administered by a Crown-owned enterprise that has failed, how can he ignore the advice of independent people who say this is possible, and why is he trying to hide behind the veil of Solid Energy, a failed company?
Speaker.
Order. The Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Mr Speaker, when the Pike Company transferred the site over to Solid Energy, with an explicit directive and budget from this government to develop a plan for entry to the drift, both that member and the families welcomed Solid Energy taking over because they were New Zealand's largest mining company, most likely to have the expertise around safety. What I find galling from that member is that the very lessons of Pike is that we should not be cavalier about safety, that we should follow the law that this Parliament passed, and that we should follow the very best of expertise in ensuring the safety of New Zealand workers.
Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Mr Speaker, how much or what percentage of the government's $1.8 billion surplus would be needed to honour the Prime Minister John Key's commitment to re-enter the drift and recover what is ever possible from that drift.
Order. The Honourable Dr.
Mr. Speaker, I have reviewed multiple quotes from the Prime Minister, and when he said at the time of the disaster that the government would make every effort to get access to the drift, he conditioned it absolutely properly if it could be done safely. And I say to this House, after the loss of life at Pike, why would we now want to be cavalier about safety?
Question number 9, Dennis O'Rourke. Oh, point of order, the Honourable Dr.
Mr. Speaker, I know there is some public interest in the issue of the new technical information in respect of Pike. I seek leave of the House to table the data that's been provided by Seagas professionals about the level of methane in the drift of the Pike mine.
In view of the sensitivity of the issue, I will put the leave. No, I just need to tidy. Leave is sought to table that technical advice, recent technical advice. Is there any objection to it being tabled? There is not. It can be tabled.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, the Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to table two documents, one being an email from Tony Forster to Bernie Monk as a representative of the families, stating quite clearly that he would be honoured to take part in or lead a drift recovery, and that is dated the 16th of November 2016, Mr. Speaker.
And the second document?
The second document is a beehive release, Mr. Speaker, outlining the CV and experience of Mr. Tony Forster when he was appointed Chief Inspector for Mines by this government.
Again, I'll put the leave for both those documents. Leave us sought to table both of them. Is there any objection to them being tabled? There is not. They can be tabled.
Nick Smith also faced this question as the Minister for Building and Housing from his Labour shadow in that portfolio, Phil Twyford.
Does he believe there needs to be a review of the building code given the damage sustained by modern buildings such as Statistics House in this week's earthquakes?
Nick Smith said the issue was not the building code, but the more detailed standards.
The overall performance of most buildings in the quake was good, but there may be others, like Standards House, that require further investigation as more information comes to hand with the hundreds of assessments that are taking place across Wellington currently.
And from earthquakes to climate change, with this question for the Prime Minister from Greens co-leader James Shaw.
Would he be prepared to join Ban Ki-moon and Francois Hollande and call on Mr Trump to drop his campaign pledge to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement?
The Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I think a better way to phrase that would be, having had a conversation with President-elect this morning, we expressed an interest at an appropriate point after he's sworn in to have a more broad discussion about a range of issues, including trade, and climate change would be one of those. I personally hope that the United States would actually honour the commitments that were made at Paris, because if you look, as I've argued so often to this House, the issue of climate change is a global issue, but we really need those huge emitters to be part of the solution, and that includes the United States, China and of course India. And the genesis of the work that President Obama did, that he took to Paris, was really a bipartisan agreement reached with Xi Jinping from China. And so the risk, of course, is that if the United States are not actively engaged, other big emitters might not be as well.
Finally, a preview of what lies ahead when Parliament resumes after this one-week adjournment with the Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday, the 29th of November, the government will look to complete the third readings of the Children, Young Persons and Their Families Advocacy, Workforce and Age Settings Amendment Bill, the Wildlife Powers Amendment Bill and a number of other bills on the order paper. Wednesday, the 30th of November, will be a Members' Day.
The Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee. I'm Tom Frewin, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.